It's been a few weeks, so I want to kind of do a little bit of a refresher of where we've been. And then my goal is to, between this Sunday and next, get to the end of chapter 25, which on the one hand seems a little daunting, but chapter 25, well, the end of 24 and chapter 25 are a series of four stories Jesus delivers. Parables, if you're familiar with that term, they very, very much fit that sort of parable type of language, at least some of them, that will teach us and instruct us how to live in light of the truth that we're going to consider today. So from verse 36 to 44, there's some therefores kind of connected into it. It's like, hey, because of this, therefore, here's the implication for you. And then there's going to be these four stories, and we'll deal with those next week, of what does it look like? And essentially, the four stories are going to have to do with how do we wait? How do we wait between Christ, who has returned to his Father, and Christ, who is going to one day return? We are in a waiting time. What does waiting look like? And if you're like me, there's like varieties of waiting, right? There's like waiting in the line for a ride. It's like, when is it going to be my turn? Or there's waiting in the principal office. I still remember that as a child. Like, I wish I could just stay in the waiting room forever. I never actually want to go. Like, so there's different kinds of waiting. We need to make sure that we are waiting well for Jesus because the stakes are high. In fact, Peter talks about this right near the end of the last little letter he writes. I'll read you some verses. I think they're important. I think they actually will help us think well through Matthew 24. He says this, "Know this first of all. Scoffers will come in the last days, with scoffing following their own sinful desire, and they will say, 'Where is the promise of his coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning.'" You get the sense, the objection. It's like, okay, you say Jesus is coming. Where is he? Nothing. It's the world has just carried on as it has right from the beginning. You can't possibly be right about this. But Peter is very insistent despite that. And he goes on and he actually starts to talk about the implications of this truth, of why it's so important. And he gets down to verse 10. And in a few minutes, when we look at chapter 24 of Matthew, you'll see even the language Peter uses, it's like he remembers what Jesus said all the way back in Matthew 24. He said, "The day of the Lord will come like a thief, and heavens will pass away." And he describes sort of the end of history, the end of creation. And then he says in verse 11, "Since all these things are thus," like since this is the way it's going to be, despite what the scoffers have to say, "What sort of people ought you to be?" You hear the language? He's like, because we have a belief that one day Jesus will return, it has some implications to the kind of people we ought to be. And then through the final verses of that letter, as he kind of hits the exclamation point of like, here's the punchline of the whole book, he starts to describe the kind of people we ought to be as followers of Jesus waiting for his return. We ought to be people who are pursuing holiness and godliness and purity and peace. I love that one because you could see that actually could fuel angst, right? Of like, well, we don't know. It's going to be sudden. It's going to be unexpected. But Peter said, no. Like when you understand the gospel message and the return of Christ and you keep the pieces in the right place, it actually fuels peace. And he goes on and then he describes right near the end of the letter, and we're going to grow in grace and we're going to grow in the knowledge of Jesus. And when I think of those things, it's like, well, I want to grow in holiness and godliness and peace and grace and the knowledge of Jesus. And if you're telling me this is one of the key building blocks that will fuel that, this is way too important to treat lightly. So with all that said, I am aware, sorry, I'm just moving this, it's going to be in my way, that some of chapter 24 what's the right word? A little controversial. Now, if you're new, maybe this is gonna, you won't see it, but if you've been around church for a while, it's actually true. I've had more than one of you come to me and like, "Are you sure you know what you're doing here? Shouldn't you have just gone from chapter 23 to 26? Because 24 and 25, it's like so many Christians get really anxious over these things. There's so many. What it amounts to is there are some things that are very, very clear in these two chapters. And then there's some other parts of it where they are admittedly extremely difficult things. And very well-intentioned Christians who believe in Jesus, who believe in the Bible, have worked through the passage in slightly different ways. I would say that probably even in this room, we will have some differences of opinion. Hopefully what we agree on together is Jesus is coming back. It's going to be awesome. It's going to be unexpected, and we ought to live prepared. The other pieces around that, it's like, yeah, we're probably going to have some disagreement. We can do that with grace. Here's why I won't avoid this. Okay, this is I've talked to a few of you, but this is the consistent answer I would give. It's just way too important. So much of Scripture rests on the fact that we have a hope in the return of Christ. And if we just say, well, you know what? There's too much controversy, so let's just kind of set that aside. It's like we are going to miss one of the key motivating factors for how we live or why we pursue godly lives, because book after book of the New Testament just lays down the gauntlet. It's like, don't shy away from the fact that we have this incredible hope. It's to motivate us. In fact, one of Paul's letters, he said, you know what, he describes us? We are the people who are preparing to marvel at his appearing. I've always loved that little expression. And if we go, well, there's too much controversy, so let's just set that side apart. It's like, how on earth will we ever be then ready to marvel when he appears if we've tried to just not talk about it because we might hit some parts where we disagree? So I am going to just step into the disagreement this morning and ask for a whole lot of grace where you go, I don't know if I see it quite like that. I used an analogy in the first service. It's imperfect, but maybe this will help kind of explain why I think this works. And this is not original to me. Others have talked about this analogy. Maybe how I'm using it's a bit different. But if you know a little bit of history, you know that if I use the expression D-Day, World War II, June 6, 1944, the Allied forces land in Normandy. Typically, if you go to Europe and you have any sort of history buff or any sort of war buff, probably you're going to want to go to the beaches and see it. And, you know, I've been there, walked some of those beaches, because we recognize something very important happened that day. 150-odd thousand men came ashore that day. It was like 7,000 boats, 13,000 aircraft, like just forces and energy and resources thrown, knowing that if they could establish a beachhead, right? That's kind of where that phrase grew into its significance. Establish a beachhead, the war could be won. And so we celebrate that day. If you tell anyone D-Day, they are going to know which D-Day. It's like, no, that's only one. That was the day. Now, that was not the day the war was won, right? V-Day happens almost a year later. What is it, May 8th, 1945? Someone can correct me if I'm wrong. I think that's what it is. The day that it was actually signed, the armistice was signed. That's the day of the victory. Now, as you think through history, both of those dates matter. But if you just had D-Day with no V-Day, you'd be missing a key part of the story. Now, here's the analogy, and it breaks down on all sorts of levels, so I am aware of that. Christ's death on the cross and his victory over sin and death is a spectacular thing. We never want to neglect it. We never want to champion it. Never stop championing it. That is massive. That's like, in the comparison, D-Day. Like, you read most historians are like, on D-Day, it was over. Like, oh, there were still battles and skirmishes, but once that beachhead was established within a few weeks, there was almost a million men had come ashore, like 500,000 pounds of equipment, like 50,000 vehicles. Like, it was over. Now, it still took a year, and so there were still battles, there was still difficulty until V-Day. For us, here's the analogy. Christ's death on the cross, our D-Day. Christ's return, our V-Day. It would seem to me to be a tragic thing if all we did was just talk about D-Day and never talk about the fact that the war eventually was won. One day, Jesus is coming back, and all the stuff now, the skirmishes, the weeping, the pain, the sin, the suffering, the death, it'll be over because there is a victory. And so we need to be able to talk about it, even though we're going to have differences. All right, that feels like a very large disclaimer. I hope it's more than that. I hope it helps you just think through it. And I hope it helps us as a church have lots of grace, even if maybe we have some slightly different views. Because if we don't have grace and then can't talk about it, man, that's even more tragic. Now, before I dive into the passage, I've been asked a few questions by more than one person. So I'm going to just answer a couple of the ones that have kept coming up. And so I apologize if these aren't your questions and they start going over your head because maybe you weren't here a few weeks ago when we were talking about it. Question number one came from, before question number one, let me just remind you the question that the disciples asked, okay? So we're all on the same page. If you look at chapter 24, verse 3, and if you don't have a Bible, please go to the connections desk before you leave. We'll give you one. The disciples come to Jesus having just heard him say that one day the temple will be destroyed. Essentially, that's what he's told them. And they come and they ask him some questions. It sounds, at first glance, like three questions. I suggested that because of the grammar of the Greek, it's actually two questions. And I really think, by the way Jesus responds, he's responding to two questions. But I kind of wonder if on the day that the disciples were asking it, they kind of thought of it really as one thing. When will the temple be destroyed? When is the end coming? And when are you coming? And the reason I think it's kind of probably in their minds maybe conflated as just one thing is because I don't think they could actually envision a time where there could be a world with no temple. The temple where God dwelled, where sin was dealt with, where you could draw near to God. Like if the temple was gone, I can't help but imagine they thought human history must have been over. But the way Jesus responds from verse 4, and if you've got one of those red letter Bibles, mine's got all the words of Jesus in red, you'll see that Jesus starts speaking in verse 4, and he doesn't stop to the end of chapter 25. And in these two chapters, I think he gives two answers. And I think the effect of that is then to sort of understand that he's going to answer one question around the temple and the time that they're living in, and that continues until his return. And then the second question about his coming and the end of all things. And the passage we're getting to this morning in verse 36, if I actually ever get there, has these words at the beginning of it. If you've got the ESV, it starts off, but concerning in verse 36, very important words, because in the Bible, those words are the way to introduce a new thought. So if you use the phrase, but concerning, it's sort of like me saying, hey, now I want to talk to you about another thing. All through, if you read Corinthians, if you ever study through Corinthians and you don't know that, Corinthians is very hard to understand. But if you do know that, you'll see it all through Corinthians. Paul uses that to say, okay, now I'm going to talk to you about a new thing. And just a very little phrase that sort of starts off something new. So the effect of it is what comes before talks about one question, what comes after talks about another question. So that's kind of what we've been working through. This is our third week in this passage as we're trying to make some sense of what's going on here. But like I said, two questions that I've been asked. One comes out of verse 22 and 24 about the elect. So that's the language of the Bible to speak of the people that God has called to himself and he saved. And verse 22 says, if those days had not been cut short, no human being would have been saved, but for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. And verse 24 says, for false Christs and false prophets will arise and perform great signs and wonders so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. It was a great question that I've heard from a couple of you that was basically, is that Jesus saying that the elect, that those God has called himself might not be saved? Like somehow there could be such a delusion or such a false prophet that could come along that we could be confused by it. And I don't believe that is what Jesus is saying at all. In fact, I think the way, if you read it and just sort of think through the logic of it, I think he's actually saying the opposite. He's saying God will do everything he needs to do to make sure he saves his people. That's kind of what verse 24, 22 is all about, right? There's going to be some hard things coming that had they continued, there would have been maybe even implication or risk for the elect. So God stops them to make sure he saves his people. And all through, again, the New Testament, actually even the Old Testament, if you want to think through this question more, go read Deuteronomy 13, 1-3, because that's the passage where God, through Moses in the Old Testament, explains actually why he sometimes allows powerful signs and wonders to be done that are not of him, but why he allows them and the purpose, one of the purposes, at least anyway, that he accomplishes through that. So the Bible is acknowledging there are powerful things that happen. They aren't just cheap parlor tricks. There is actually a very real power at work. It's the power of Satan that God allows to happen that have a misleading or deluding type effect, but God is going to protect and spare his people. There's tons of verses. One of my favorites out of 1 Peter, verse 5 of chapter 1. Let me just read it for you. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his great mercy has caused us to be born again to a living hope. Isn't that great? I just love the language. It's God's great mercy that has given you a living hope. That's what's at stake. That's what our message is we have a God who who has great mercy, and he wants you to have a hope that will never fade. In fact, that's what the passage goes on to talk about, of the hope that we have through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead to obtain an inheritance which is imperishable and undefiled and will not fade away, reserved in heaven for you who are protected by the power of God. You get that's a potent phrase. If you've come to know and taste the goodness of Jesus and trust him, that's God's work in you. And he will protect it. Every once in a while, I've had someone ask me the question over the years. Like, do you think a Christian can lose their salvation? I usually answer with a question, which is annoying, I know, to many people. Well, let me ask you this. And here's the question I ask. Who saved you? Did you save you or did God save you? Because honestly, if my answer is I saved me, it was Don Reeves' efforts and goodness and wisdom, then let me tell you, there is no chance I will be able to see myself through to the end. I'm not strong enough, good enough, wise enough. If it's up to me, no, I can guarantee you, I will not make it. But if God is the one who saved, and as I look back through my story, I don't know if you're like this, but you know, at the time, maybe you thought you were making decisions and praying prayers, and then you look back one day, and it's like, hold on a second. Through that whole thing, the hand of God was at work. That was God doing all that. If God's the one who saves us, can he fail in his purpose and power? 1 Peter 1:5 is saying no. I'm pretty confident the answer is no. If God saved you, you are saved and your inheritance is kept imperishable and undefiled and reserved in heaven for you. God will save his people. That's question number one. I know there's more to it than that, but that's just a quick. Question number two, do I believe in a rapture? Well, isn't that an interesting question? Yeah, I know. So for those of you who don't know the language of rapture, I'm going to give a really bad definition. But essentially, there's multiple definitions, but it essentially boils down to, will God remove his people from this earth before the coming of Jesus? I mean, I get it. That's a very very surfacey type of a definition. The reason I've gone that way is because there's lots of different views of what the rapture looks like. So my answer is, yes, I believe that God will remove his people. The challenge is I don't see it in Matthew 24. And I'll point out the key passage when we get there that's kind of up for dispute. I see something else happening in Matthew 24. I do see it in places like 1 Corinthians 15 and 1 Thessalonians 4. So I see it. I am uncertain of like the when and some of the logistics around it, but I see God's saving hand over his people in that way, just not here. And I know, again, this is probably one of those passages where some of us would see things a little different. I'll point out, for those of you who haven't really ever wrestled this through, the passage where this comes up. But in a nutshell, just so you know, that's kind of how I slice that. That is a huge topic. So you're like, well, that is a very quick answer. It's like, yep. Quick answer to something that we could probably spend the rest of the day talking about. But I just wanted cards on the table for that one. So let's dive in. We've just got a few minutes here to make a little bit of progress. But that's okay, because the lesson is actually remarkably simple. The point Jesus is making in this passage is much more focused than I think we often realize. He's just talked about all sorts of things that are going on in the world around us. In verse 29, I think he starts talking about, and this was a few weeks ago, I was preaching from this passage about his return. And so the language of that passage is very much the language of Christ's return. He does return. In fact, he biblically speaking, he has to return for all the pieces to work. By the way, I think the biblical worldview is wonderfully coherent. Every one of us has to have a worldview. We've talked about this a little bit, right? Worldview has to at least answer four questions. And you might not have ever thought of your worldview, but you've got one. It's worth thinking it through. So the four questions every worldview has to answer: where do we come from? And in answering that, you will also come up with the answer why you're here, right? We believe God created everything. We are made in his image. There is a purpose and a design behind it. That's very different than an answer of we have evolved from something, right? They're both answers to the question, but they have massively different implications than of not only where do we come from, but why and what is the purpose in that. Question number two is, what is wrong with the world? It is an undeniable fact that there is something wrong with the world, right? And there's lots of different answers to what that might be. The third question is, what's the solution? How do you fix it? And then the final one is, where does it all go? What is the conclusion of this? Every one of us has a worldview that answers that. The Christian, the biblical worldview is remarkably coherent. You might not agree with it. You might say, no, I don't believe it. But what you can't deny is the fact that it perfectly answers those four questions and does it in a wonderfully coherent, beautiful, actually. It's more than just like logically coherent. It's actually a beautiful answer. And part of the answer is that Christ returns. That's part of the solution. Yes, he dies on the cross. He deals with sin, death. We can be forgiven. But we still look around. It's like, but the world is still broken. The rest of the answer comes at Christ's return. So we've been looking at that, and you can see in verse 29 to 31, this cataclysmic sort of language around his return. Like, it's like all of creation is just like literally shaking as he returns, because it is a massive moment when his kingdom is finally established. You see, Jesus, when he's born, he's a king, is he not? Remember the wise men come? Whereas he has been born king of the Jews. But it's not a fully realized kingdom yet. He is a king, but in Matthew 12, he gets into a conversation about casting out demons, and he starts to talk about, you know, the kingdom of God is at hand. It's like, but I thought he was born a king, and yet you're saying there's still an aspect in which it's still coming. Yes, and then he dies on a cross, and Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 talks about that moment being a moment where his kingdom is being established. I'm like, okay, but I thought he was a king at the start, and I thought he was a king in a ministry, but you're telling me now he's a king there. It's like, yes, you can see the kingdom growing. And then scripture speaks of his return in that Daniel 7 sort of language. Some of you will be very familiar with that passage. Sort of the ultimate establishment of his kingdom. And so theologians often use the language of already but not yet. Sort of an interesting little phrase where it's recognizing, it's like there is a sense in which Jesus is king right now. And there is a sense in which one day it will be fully realized. It is already there, but something still to come. And it comes upon his return. And that's the language being picked up there. But verse 36, now I have to jump in here. Sermon starts now. But concerning that day and hour. So now he's speaking of, I'm suggesting to you, the second question. When is the end? When are you coming? And the Bible language around that day, that hour, that's all the way back in the Old Testament. This is not new language. That day language is the day of the Lord, when God comes and sets everything right concerning that day, that hour. No one knows. Not the angels. Not even the Son. That's himself. Which for many of us are like, okay, that's the next tricky thing. How can Jesus, who is fully divine, not know? If he's God, shouldn't he know everything? Isn't that what it means to be God? The language around that typically we use is omniscient. He knows all things. And yet Jesus is saying, I don't know that. Now, I think it's worth wrestling through that a little bit, because this will not be the only time in Scripture where this issue comes up for us who are believers in Jesus, where you have to put the pieces together. Some people put them together really poorly. We know Jesus is both fully human and fully divine. We know from Philippians chapter 2 that in coming to earth, he set aside something. And we certainly know that all through the Gospels, there are moments where he knows more than a human. He knows what's in the heart of everyone. But then there's other times where he's asking questions and he's surprised. Luke 2:52 tells us he grew in wisdom and knowledge. It's like, well, if he knew all things, how can that happen? So how do you answer that? How do you put the pieces together that he is both fully man and fully God? And in a place like this says, I don't know something, only the Father knows. There's been lots of attempts. I think it's actually, I'm gonna say simple, but that feels almost, and so I think the answer is plain. And here's how I think it should be put together. That Jesus does nothing independent from his Father. There will be no independent uses of the attributes of divinity aside from his Father. So there are attributes of divinity, very clear. You can't go walk on water. Jesus could. You can't stop a storm with a single word. Jesus could. You can't forgive sins. In fact, lots of people pointed out that. It's like, who can forgive sins but God alone? And Jesus did. So at times he is exercising the attributes of divinity. At other times, he restrains himself. In fact, there's a really important moment. Remember his temptation? Satan comes, is like, hey, why don't you turn the rocks to bread? Now, that's not a temptation for you. Right? You go out hiking and you run out of granola bars, you might wish you could do, but you're not actually having to really wrestle with that. You can't do that. Jesus could, if the Bible is to be believed and he is fully God. He could have done that. Notice he doesn't. What's the heart of the temptation? I think the heart of the temptation is to take back the attributes of divinity that his father had not permitted him to use for his purposes. And so Jesus will say in places like John, the Gospel of John is full of this, I say nothing except what the Father tells me to say. I do nothing except what the Father tells me to do. I submit to him. I will only use the attributes of divinity when I am dependent on the Father. And here is one of these great moments where he says, I don't know because I've submitted myself to the Father, and I will only work and use those attributes as established by him. Now, that's actually pretty important to one of the applications of this. No one knows the time or the hour, the day or the hour. I've actually literally heard people over the years, it's like, well, no one knows the day or the hour, but doesn't say anything about the week or the month. And so Jesus is coming back and they fill in the blank with a date. That's craziness. That's tragic. Because the point of the phrase is the fact that we don't know. It's actually almost blasphemous. Maybe, I said in the first, I have to think about this one. It actually might be to make a claim like that. But here's the tragic part. Over human history, lots of people have done it. I remember as a teenager seeing the book, 88 Reasons Jesus Will Come Back in 1988. Anyone ever see that one? If you did, throw it out. Because Jesus says no one knows. It's not 1988, it's not the year 2000, it's not 2012, it's not 1986. And here's why that's so damaging is because the world looks on at that craziness coming out of Christians and are like, you know what? You said it again, you got it wrong again. And if you can't get it right about his return, how do we know anything you even are saying about his first coming can be trusted? Like that's the level of implication. This isn't like stuff we can just kind of toy around with without consequence. It's got real consequence. And Jesus point blank says, nobody knows. That's the first big step in his answer to the disciples. Now, I'm going to move real quick to what he says next. He's going to use some analogies. The first analogy is to Noah. And if you look at verse 37, he says, for as were the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. So he says, like, there's something similar about Noah, the story of the flood, the ark, and my coming. Now, it's not everything is similar. That's not the point. It's not like, hey, when I come, I'm coming in a boat. Like, the point is there is something that is comparable. And if you walk through the comparison, for in those days before the flood, they were eating, drinking, marrying, giving in marriage. In other words, they were doing normal everyday stuff. They're, you know, moving to the suburbs and doing another course for work and, you know, getting groceries. Like, that's just the language of, like, they were just doing normal life. And then suddenly, bam, it happened. Verse 39, they were unaware until the flood came and swept them all away. And Jesus says something about that is similar to my coming. Now, I think there's only one similar feature. That is the suddenness, the unexpectedness. Remember what he's just told us? No one knows the time of the day. The people in Moses' day, they watched him build an ark. They mocked him. They're like, what a nut job. He's building an ark. It took a decade. It took over 100 years. There's not going to be any flood. You don't even know. And so they were just doing life. And then it came. And Jesus said, that's the nature of my return. He carries on, verse 40. Then two men will be in the field. One will be taken, one will be left. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one taken, one left. Remember I said some people see in this passage a teaching around rapture? These are the two verses. And so here's the issue you have to think through. Is verse 40 and 41 another analogy type passage where he's like, my return will be like this? Or is it literally this? When I return, it will be literally like this. I don't lose a ton of sleep over it. I can see both. I understand why both positions are held. I probably find the literal idea of it a little harder to believe, only because it seems like the point Jesus is making about Noah and the ark is the suddenness and unexpectedness of it. And I don't anticipate that necessarily in the future when Jesus returns, we would find a scenario where two women would be grinding. Because that's kind of how you would have to take it, that there would literally be people doing these activities. Regardless of how you slice it and where you think it gets to there, the point is the same. The therefore, verse 32, The application, the reason he gives us the little message is this: therefore, stay awake, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming. Jesus is coming. It will be glorious. It'll be obvious when he does come. He's already told us that back in chapter 24, verse 27. It'll be unmistakable, like lightning through the sky. Glorious, obvious, and unexpected. Now, in case we missed it, he gives us one last little story. Verse 43, know this, that if the master of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have let his house be broken into. Now, Jesus is now comparing himself to a thief, not on the moral level, not on the level of deception, again, for one reason, right? He's going to go away. He's going to come back. Suddenness. And he says, it's kind of like if you had a house and you knew a thief was going to come, you would probably stay alert to it. A number of years, about 5 years ago, my wife and I, we had gone up to Cal Park. So right around Bethlehem Star. Some of you might remember this moment of my life. It was fairly anxious for about a month. Our car was broken into. We didn't know. Because it turned out, we found out later that the kind of car we had, they had those little override buttons that you thought you'd locked your car, but turns out someone could hold the button down and you didn't. So they stole our credit cards and enough information to call the bank and change all our PINs and rack up thousands of dollars. I did say in the first service, I'm terrible at ending stories. I apologize for that. Lots of times I like start a story that illustrates something and I don't tell you how it all ends. Later I have like, how did it end? I'm like, what? The story you told. I'm like, oh, it all ended up fine. But it took about a month to get there because the bank claimed it was us because of the PIN. So they weren't going to just like say it was fraud. But here's the analogy. Here's the application part of that story. Once I found out what they had done, I cannot tell you how many times I went over in my head, like, if I had just tried to open the handle. Like, what was I thinking? You walk away, you push the little button, it goes click, click, beep, or whatever the thing is. Had I just done that, I would have seen the car was unlocked. Over and over and over, it's like I became like obsessed in my head. The point of this little story, Jesus says, if you knew a thief was coming in the night, don't you think you would do whatever you would need to do to be ready for that? Yes, that's the point. And he says to us, I am coming. Don't then you think you ought to do whatever is needed to be ready for my appearing? Verse 44 is his last application. You see, verse 42 and 44 are the two therefores. These are the applications. These are the take-homes. Therefore, you must also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. Obvious, unexpected, glorious. He is coming. And notice who it is who's coming. And I'll end here, verse 42. Sometimes people say, well, Jesus never claims to be God. Like he does all over the place. Here's another one. Therefore, stay awake, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming. What's the question he's been asked all the way back in verse 3? When are you coming? Tell us if you're coming. He's like, I'll tell you of my coming. But you want to know who the you is, who I am? I'm your Lord. I'm your God. I'm going to come. And because of who I am, the stakes could not be higher to be ready when I appear. Hence Peter, 2 Peter. If this is thus, what sort of people ought we to be? Living with godliness and holiness and peace and grace and the knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. And with that, we'll end. We'll pick up next week as Jesus gives four stories of how it is that we wait between now and then, what our waiting looks like, what it is that we do as his people so that we are ready for his coming.